This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about Niksen, which translates directly as doing nothing in Dutch. But in addition to being a handy word, which is equivalent to two words in our language, it's also grown to become this whole concept, almost like a lifestyle, of doing nothing as a way to relieve stress, anxiety, certain pressures in your life by not adding another thing to do. And so this is a really interesting interview with Olga Mecking, who wrote an entire book around this concept. Yeah, different European perspective on mental health. And also, how rare is it that we're looking at something which is not, here's a new thing to do for your mental health, but instead, here's where sometimes not doing anything may be the thing that helps it, in moderation.
Yeah, absolutely, in moderation. But it interests me just hearing you talk about it, because I think, I wonder how you got on with the concept when it first initially came under your radar. How did you feel about doing nothing? Because I don't get the sense, Bob, that you're very good at doing nothing. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you are accurate. It's not something I'm very good at. And I even try very hard not to be a real second screen person. So, you know, you're watching TV, but you're also like doing work on your phone at the same time or whatever. Like, that's the thing I'm trying to cut out, is not multitasking constantly, let alone finding periods of time when I'm doing nothing. But I think we talked about it previously with our technology episode, how one of the things that we're both missing is the time when you daydream whilst you're traveling somewhere. This is almost a slightly misleading concept, because as humans, we can't do nothing. You know, we're always breathing, we're always doing something, we're always thinking, but it's the idea of not intentionally doing a task. And so that can be very kind of relaxing and centering, but also a bit like we've talked about with meditation, oftentimes something interesting comes up. So you might not be consciously doing a task, but you might find yourself thinking something over.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. And I was just going to touch on that, because as much as the concept seems to relate itself to, or people might take it in that, if you are stressed or you're feeling anxious about something, or things that your mind is, as people say, working overtime, the concept of doing nothing can really help then to relieve some of that. But actually, what I think people sometimes don't realize is that the doing nothing actually is really beneficial to productivity and creativity. There's an article I read, and this was relating to like the workplace, that was written by a professor in leadership development and organizational change. And he spoke a lot about the benefits in terms of the creativity, and actually said that if we don't allow ourselves periods of uninterrupted, freely associated thought, then personal growth, insight, and creativity are less likely to emerge. And I think that's really important, because it's not just, as you mentioned, they're not doing anything to take away what might be inhibiting you or causing you pain, but actually not doing anything to add value and add creativity and giving you that space to innovate and to think about something new or to create something different, see the world around you in a different way.
Yeah, definitely. We're so keen to be doing something constantly to feel that we're being productive members of society, and actually we've maybe gone too far with that. So I think that point about creativity really illustrates it. And it can be scary how normalized this is. So I found one study from the National Charity Partnership in the States from 2016. They looked at the routines of 1,700 employees and found that up to 70% of them spend their allocated breaks at their desk.
Wow.
And I've certainly known so many workplaces that are like that. There's certain workplaces where that is what everybody does. You know, maybe you have a canteen, but for whatever reason, people are in the habit of not using it.
Yes, Bobby, I agree. And I also think even when you do go to a canteen, you're now taking another screen with you. So even if you do leave your desk, the concept of leaving your desk is to clear your head. But actually, you're taking another screen and you're now on your phone in the canteen, especially if you take breaks by yourself, as opposed to, you know, when I'm at home working, which is all the time, and I'm actually going to take with me after today, I'm going to tell Anthony, my partner, that there's a thing now called second screening. And I'm going to elaborate, because he likes to say, I'm in the room with you, we're watching this movie, just got a bit of work to do at the same time, so I'm just going to be on my laptop and we just watch this. And I get really annoyed thinking, you're not doing either well.
Yeah. No, then I don't feel I'm watching it with somebody.
I don't.
So yeah, me and Kat are really strict about that. If we've decided to watch something together, we will watch it together. We can second screen on our own. That's fine. That's our own business.
Yeah, I like it. Second screening. I'm gonna say to him, oh, I've had an amazing episode today at work on the podcast. There's a research about second screening, how bad it is for your mental health.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's the thing though, it's constant, and it's just that potential overstimulation that you're getting so much information in. You know, my parents do it. They watch the news and then they're looking at the news on their phone at the same time, and I'm like, no wonder you feel overwhelmed by watching the news sometimes, because you get
a double whammy of the news. You're absolutely right. And I would like to make the point though that I understand, as do probably many of our listeners, and I know you do, Bob, that sometimes when you are in a quiet space or you're not doing anything, especially if you're somebody that lives with mental illness or experiences the highs and lows, which many of us do, sometimes doing nothing can trigger and evoke thought that potentially might not have been there because you were distracted.
Yeah.
So I do recognise that that can be a thing. But I think in that moment, the doing nothing can be that you can actually take notice of things around you, like the environment. I bang on a lot about it. And I know over during COVID, we spoke a lot about that, going for walks and checking out the environment. But you can do nothing but pay attention to what's around you. And that can help then your mind not wander, if you're somebody whose mind likes to wander and often down a path that you don't want it to go down. So still pay attention, but to the things around you, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess that's the kind of compromise, and that's probably more me. Like, I'm really going to try and embrace this and find a space for it in my life. But I'm aware that the easier compromise for me will be doing less. You know, so just off air, we were talking about, I did a Sudoku puzzle over Christmas and I really struggled with it. I just picked it up in a newspaper and I got quite worried of like, oh, can I not do these anymore? Is this a skill that I've lost? Maybe I'm aging. I don't know. But yeah, so I bought myself a little Sudoku book and I'm working through 100 of the puzzles and building that skill up again, because, you know, I like that that's something I can do and I didn't want to lose it. And it's something where it's not a screen. It's a relatively kind of linear task in, I'm, you know, dealing with numbers. There's no kind of grander concept I have to think about.
Mm.
So that's maybe a compromise that people can make. They can find these kind of smaller tasks that don't have any big consequence and do one of those. Because if I get stuck and I have to put the book down, that is not earth shattering. I will come back to it. Whereas a lot of my work, if I get stuck, I can have negative feelings about it.
Absolutely. And moving through different screens onto something else that's then not great. If you get stuck at work, then you might move on to something else and see somebody having the most amazing life on Instagram, you know, and then that just spirals you out of control, as you can really focus on doing nothing, but even doing nothing but maybe reading, like you said. Yeah, if people need a compromise and doing nothing but being attentive to the world around you seems a bit of a push, then yeah, maybe pick something up and read. I mean, I said to my sister the day, you know, we were looking at books and she was like, I've just got so much on my Kindle. She loves books, but she's like, I've got so much now on my Kindle that I just don't buy them anymore. And because I travel so much, it's obviously easier to travel with my Kindle. Now she's in London for a year. She's saying, I'm just going to fill, you know, my new apartment with a few books and I'll dish them out when I leave and go home, because I am really missing not being on a screen and just sitting with my book and him just holding a book. So yeah, I think there's lots of different ways to do nothing. But I'm kind of down with this. I'm really looking forward to this episode. I'm quite good at it. I'm not being boastful, but I am quite good at doing nothing, and people might see that as negatively. I don't.
I love that. What a fun skill. Well, that's very you, isn't it? Being in the moment.
Very much me being in the moment. And I guess you can also do that because maybe I'm good at it because I've got such a hectic life. So I really love when I do nothing. You know, I've got my two daughters
really
and I'm busy
need it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I really do need it. And I enjoy it when it comes because I think, like when people don't like to go in a restaurant on their own or don't want to do something on their own, I guess when you're around people a lot and you're busy, I just really enjoy that, sitting with a book and just being on my own. It just doesn't happen as often as I'd like it to be, but I am quite good at when it's time to do nothing. I am quite good at it. But lately, it's not gone so well because I've got back into screens and that's what I've got to stop. It's COVID that's done it. Phone, laptop, iPad, telly. You know, when you get a chance to switch off.
All of them telling us bad news.
Yeah, all of them telling us bad news.
So, yeah, definitely a relevant concept for the times. Really interesting interview and a little bit unexpected to start off with because we start off by talking about parenting. So there may be some relevance there for you as well. It's a story I was surprised we started with. I didn't see it coming. So there's a teaser for you. So with all that said, we'll get into this conversation with Olga Mecking in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Olga, and in 2011, a woman called the police on me because my eldest daughter had a temper tantrum in public. And this got me interested in topics like parenting and mental health. And later in all those different wellness trends, because I also live abroad. So I live in the Netherlands. I'm originally from Poland. My husband is German. So I'm really interested in that international aspect.
I just want to pause there, actually, with what happened with you and your daughter. Do you know now the reason why the police were called, like what that person thought was happening?
Yes, so there are two reasons. First of all, I wanted her to go in the stroller and she didn't. She wanted to walk. But the situation was, we lived in Delft, which has lots of, it's very cute, but it has lots of canals and water. And she was 2 years old. I had another baby 6 weeks prior, so I wasn't thinking very clearly. And I just wanted her to be safe in a stroller so I wouldn't have to, you know, run after her or something. And since that woman saw me from above, from her window, it would look as if I was hitting her or something because I would put her in a stroller, she would grow out of the stroller, I would put her in, she would grow out. So it totally created this impression of me, you know, doing something to her. And the other reason was, sadly, because I speak Polish to my kids and I didn't speak Dutch then. And her first thought was, like, she wouldn't consider me the mother. She thought I was the nanny or the au pair. And I didn't speak Dutch then. And I think what really triggered her to call the police was that I told her in English because I was very tired and I wanted to go home and make dinner. I told her to just leave me alone because I wasn't thinking very well. And that kind of made her go, oh, okay, yeah, I'm calling the police now. A combination of this situation where she didn't see clearly what's happening and me being, you know, from Eastern Europe and her having all the stereotypes about me.
That must have been so difficult. And so what happened? Did the police arrive at that point?
I called my husband and he couldn't believe what was happening. He was like, no, she's not calling the police. Like, yeah, she is calling the police right now. And then I was really lucky because it was in front of the daycare. I just picked her up. So the daycare ladies were ready to go home, you know, after the whole day of sitting around with kids. And they saw me crying on the street and they stayed with me until the police arrived and they talked to this woman and they took my side and they explained everything to the police in Dutch. And they said, oh no, you know, we know this mom, her kids go to our daycare, she would never do anything like that. And yeah, as we say it in Polish, luck in an unlucky situation.
That's exactly what I was thinking, actually, of, you know, it's just as well it happened there and you had the support of the daycare, but at the same time, it shouldn't have happened, but you can see, you know, why maybe that woman had some of the concerns. Obviously, I'm not on board with the profiling of what she thought of you, maybe because of your ethnicity. And so this got you interested in writing and perhaps the differences between how people think and perceive situations.
Yeah. And also because I realized how isolated I was, because for so long I thought, oh, you know, I don't even know where I got this idea that I should be doing everything myself. like in terms of house and kids. I was working my thesis at the university then, so that was kind of work. And I thought, oh no, I'm going to do it myself. I still don't understand how I even got this idea, but there it was. And so I started thinking about this, and I did two things. One was finding a real life playgroup in my area with kids the same age as mine. And the second thing I did was starting a blog. And that was like this first story that I wrote on my blog.
Yeah, it's good that you were able to, you know, get that out there and not hang on to this, because I think many parents, particularly women, can feel very judged for their parenting. And it can be very easy to internalize that. So even though you saw that you weren't doing anything wrong in that situation, you could have still felt a lot of shame and embarrassment for it.
Yeah, I did. And sometimes I still do when I go out with my kids. It's never, you know, I just never go out. I always think, oh, they will behave, because I really don't want that to happen again. It's not one thing that happened. It's going to affect me for, you know, a long time. I don't think it's something that's going to go away, and I can, you know, I can deal with it. But I agree with the part that you said about judgment and shame. And sometimes there's just a flippant comment that people say to a parent sometimes. And for them, it's nothing. But for the parents, it's, you know, it's a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Going to affect them.
Absolutely. And particularly when you're already struggling, not knowing the language and maybe feeling a bit out of place.
Absolutely. And it never happened again. I've never had any. Usually the Dutch are, they really like kids here. And kids are welcomed and listened to, and they're given a voice. So I don't know. It must have been a really weird sort of situation for that to happen, because it's never happened again.
That's good. And then, you know, you start this blog. At what point did Nixon come in?
Yeah, so last year. So I went from blogging to freelance writing gradually, not all at once. But maybe I think in 2016 I started pitching my writing to first other bigger blogs and then to magazines and publications. And then I just kind of pitched bigger and bigger newspapers and publications. And with Nixon, what happened was I wrote a story about that for the New York Times, and it went viral. And that's how the book happened.
It's so incredible. We hear so many stories like that, where it takes one thing that really resonates at the right time. And I can absolutely see the appeal for you in terms of what this is. So would you mind sharing what Nixon is to you?
Yeah, so I was actually struggling to find a good definition for it, because what is doing nothing? It's like negative space, very hard to define. But one of the experts I talked to defined it as doing nothing without the purpose. So it has like two parts. One was doing nothing. So you're not browsing Facebook, you're not watching Netflix, you're not reading a book. And all those things can be great. And the second part is that it's without a purpose. So I think too many times or too often we think everything we do has to have a philosophy behind it. I think we've forgotten how to do things because they're fun. We don't run because it's a nice way of moving. We run because we want to lose weight or because we think we should be doing some sports. We never do it just because. And I think the nice thing about Nixon is this part that we can do it just because, for no reason at all.
Right. I love that. And it really fascinates me, because I think we're at a weird point in history where there's so many examples of things like that, where essentially we are doing what humans were naturally inclined to, that we've made our lives so busy and hectic and we're constantly striving for efficiency and perfection. In doing so, we've lost touch, I think, with a lot of what we need. I want to say almost left to our own devices, but I guess, you know, maybe the nearest example is perhaps going on holiday nowadays. You know, when you've got time that you know, okay, I've got 2 weeks, I shouldn't be doing any work for it. And then you find yourself eating when you're hungry and daydreaming whenever you feel like it. You know, another example would be like the huge trend nowadays in high intensity training. You know, this idea of like doing really short bursts of exercise very intensely, then slowing down, then doing it again. That's no different to how at one point humans would have survived. Sometimes we need to run and other times we need to rest. It's like we've almost had to create a concept around things we would have naturally been inclined to do because we've been so busy not doing them.
Yeah, and I think that's happening. What I've noticed by reading parenting books and also wellness articles and books is that, well, most of wellness is very individualized. It's, you know, you, and you have to make yourself feel better by eating or by moving or by kind of doing some kind of work on yourself. And I read that's important, but if it doesn't work for some people, or if people are struggling with some sort of trend or some sort of wellness method, they feel very guilty that they feel they're like losers. They feel terrible.
Mm.
And I think that's sad because, okay, maybe the wellness method that you're looking at isn't, you know, perfect, or it doesn't work for everyone, or it just doesn't work for anyone at all. It's just hyped up. Or maybe it doesn't work for you. It's okay. But people are really beating themselves up for it, for not being able to eat in a certain way or to do certain amount of work on yourself or not being mindful enough.
Yeah. And I think there's something beautifully straightforward about Nixon in that way, in that people often compare it to meditation because there are some similarities, but it's in a way less intentional. You know, with meditation, you're focusing on the breath or specific parts of your practice as a way to disconnect from stresses and instead focus on only what's happening right now and what thoughts and feelings are coming up and your surroundings. Whereas with this, it's like that, but with less intention. You're not focusing on anything specific.
Exactly, exactly. I was talking to a friend and she really likes sitting at a cafe and, you know, drinking my coffee, watching people go by. Sounds really like Nixon. So I guess I know there are many types of meditation and maybe there is some overlap.
Yeah, definitely, particularly on the mindfulness side. You know, people talk about all sorts of areas of mindfulness that can sound quite appealing, like mindful eating, where, you know, you take the time to really pay attention to your food. And often people do it with something very simple, like an orange, and you really sit there and analyze the orange. And people love the idea of it because they're like, what, I get to eat and focus on my food? That sounds great fun. But it's quite an important practice. But again, it could go on my list of, well, why weren't we focusing on our food before? You know, why had we fallen into these routines of, oh, I have to read the paper while I'm eating breakfast, otherwise I'll be uninformed. And so there's all these areas where it just makes sense, like unprocessed foods being healthier for us. Yeah. Like that shouldn't have come as a surprise.
Yeah, no, I do enjoy cooking a lot. So I cook and bake a lot.
And so for you then, what have you found Nixon's helped with? Was it good in terms of stress and mental health generally?
It can be, although I was actually also not just interested in areas where Nixon can be helpful, but also where I thought there are some areas where you shouldn't do nothing. For example, if you're really, really, really stressed and if you're not doing well at all, then maybe doing nothing might not be the way for you. Instead, my expert told me, or maybe try, you know, something, an activity back home that would make your hands busy, but let your brain sort of unfocus, like knitting. Many people started knitting. Companies like Lego started doing bricks for adults who are really stressed and not doing well. So those are actually...
Wow. It's a kind of scary state of affairs though, isn't it? Essentially, adults need toys and daydreaming because we've so overworked ourselves.
You know, you could see it as a first step towards doing nothing if that's where you want to get.
Mm.
So you could start, you know, because the first step, if you're really, right, if you're that sort of level of anxiety and stress, then you can't go from there to doing nothing. It would be good for you to do an activity that's a little bit calmer, or maybe go for a walk, or maybe do something that's easy, or maybe read a book to get yourself to a situation or get help. Very important, get help from an expert or a therapist or talk to a friend so you can finally get yourself to a situation where you can say, okay, this is me now. I'm feeling better. What can I do now? Do I want to do this? Do I not want to do this? Maybe you can do nothing for a while.
Right, absolutely. And that's something that can be a really difficult balance, you know, that there's all these opinions and all this kind of self-help perspective on how we prioritize our tasks. Like we're almost encouraged to find some kind of golden answer. If only I strategize my tasks in this way, then everything will be done. But really, you know, modern life is a never-ending list of tasks. Whatever you do, your brain will naturally find more things for you to do. So I guess it's engaging with the side of yourself that does the opposite a bit more. You know, finding time to do less can be really powerful. And, you know, for me, I guess whilst it's something that I'd not known a huge amount in terms of the Dutch sense, I'd known about other writers that have talked about the power of boredom, you know, being maybe the more Americanized version of that, as, you know, as something we've also lost. We've sort of micromanaged ourselves out of boredom. And then, you know, we can find ourselves in the pandemic and be bored and be quite worried by the boredom because we're so unused to it.
Yeah, definitely. Although in the book I say boredom isn't doing nothing because, well, I keep thinking that I get very bored when I'm cleaning. I hate cleaning and I'd rather not be doing it. I'd rather be doing something else. So I'm never bored when I do nothing, but I'm always bored when I'm cleaning. So the definition of boredom that I read and use in the book is that you're bored when you're doing something, but you'd rather be doing something else, or you're somewhere, but you'd rather be somewhere else. But I know researchers like Sandy Mann, the British psychologist, she described boredom in this positive way, how it makes people more creative and how she put people in a situation in like a sensory deprived room where they had nothing to touch, nothing to look at, nothing to hear. And their brains would kind of go and search for their own stimulation, and that leads to increased creativity. And that's also what what doing nothing does. It makes you more creative because the best moments, best ideas don't come when you're focusing on solving the problem. They come when you're unfocused and having 10,000 thoughts at once, and you're on a walk or you're cycling or you're maybe reading a book or you're doing nothing or you're baking. And that's where you get the best ideas.
Right. And I think that's a more natural way for our creative minds to work. It depends on the type of task you do. But I've got a friend that is an artist and she, you know, has burnout with her art where she works really hard and can overwork. And then it zaps her creativity when she's too tired or she's done too many projects recently. And she finds that not necessarily doing nothing, but like you've talked about, doing less can be a good bridge for that. One thing she'll do is have coloring books. She's really funny about talking about it sometimes because she's like, people might look down on me having a coloring book, you know, or think it's childish. But for her, it's really helpful. It's something she can do, which is creative and small and easy. And so she finishes coloring something in and it's still pretty, but it didn't take up any creative space for her. And so it's a way to kind of recharge, but still do something creative. And then she's maybe like, okay, now I've looked at this long enough, I'm itching to get back to something more challenging.
Yes, I totally understand that. And I think in creative work, me as a writer and her as a painter, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of creative work isn't the writing itself, isn't the painting itself or the dancing or the sculpting or whatever it is that you do. It's actually those moments where you don't seem to be really doing anything, but you're maybe taking a walk. But inside of your head, your brain is working. And that's what makes all those ideas kind of bump into each other and create new ideas. And I was really interested in this concept of invisible work, how a lot of what artists and writers do isn't, and scientists. My father is a scientist and a theoretical physicist. So a lot of what he does is just sitting there with a piece of paper and doing some, you know, writing formulas. Yeah, so a lot of this kind of work is actually invisible because you need a lot of thinking before you get to the visible part.
Mm, I really like that. It's similar to the concept people talk about of an iceberg as well, right? People that we really look up to in their careers, particularly those that are freelance and we don't see a lot of their work because they're doing it maybe at home. We see them doing a really impressive photo shoot or out, you know, shooting a movie or whatever their area of creativity is. And we don't see them sitting at home doing invoicing for hours, which they hate, but they have to do it, you know, or sending like cold emails to people they've not met in the hope of securing more work.
Yeah, of course. Like, I think there's also this idea of instant success, which is quite harmful. I mean, people ask me, no, you just seem to come out of nowhere with that book. And I said, no, it wasn't out of nowhere. I had been writing for 10 years.
Absolutely. And you've been, more importantly than that, you know, Anne Lamont, one of my favorite writers, talks about, you know, sometimes you have to write 10 bad pages to get one good one. And I think with creative endeavors, it can be easier to see that. Whereas maybe if you have a more corporate environment job, it can be difficult because it's maybe a type of work where it's not as easy to recognize your progress. But even if it's something like a task you do every day, you're probably getting faster at it than when you started. For some people, whereas for other people, it's this photograph is shot completely differently to how I would have done it a year ago.
Yeah.
It's different for all of us. But the key point of all of that is we have to take the time to reflect and develop. We can't be machines. You had to write a lot of different things to find this one that really resonated with you and also with the public and the demand for it.
Yeah, exactly. So the whole story started with an article I read in a Dutch magazine called Nixon is the New Mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved it. Well, first of all, because I'm a language geek. So I speak 5 languages. English is my 3rd.
Wow.
And
So what are the 5?
So Polish, German, English, French, and Dutch.
Wow.
And I really love that. Well, first of all, that there was one word for doing nothing, and the Dutch being very efficient and practical with the language, they just say Nixon, which is, I thought it was really cool.
Mm.
You know how you sometimes read a word in another language that describes some sort of complicated feeling that you've experienced but had no words for, and then you recognize that it's like, yeah, this is what it's like. Like this Japanese word that meant, I'm not hungry, but I'm eating because my mouth is lonely.
Oh, yes, I've heard of this one.
But when Nixon and I had the same sort of recognition, was like, oh, there's one word for, like, one label for doing nothing, and that's really cool. And the second was, as I mentioned, how wellness trends or wellness in general always has us work on ourselves. The problem with that, of course, is that, well, we feel really terrible when it fails because we think it's our own fault. And it's also blames the individual for their own problems. And, you know, a lot of our well-being is also cultural and how, for example, the government is helping you, if at all. And what is your environment? And what is your wider situation that goes beyond just you? And I thought that those books didn't mention this aspect at all, being so individualized and being so focused on you know, you as the person and your well-being. In my book, I thought I'd do something different, because having lived in different countries, in Poland, in Germany, now in the Netherlands, in Canada for a while, I thought it would be interesting to show a more global perspective and show how culture kind of can influence our thinking.
Right. And I think that is so fascinating that I only speak English, and so I a bit of French, but I don't have that experience of viewing the world via different languages. And I think it can be really helpful to people to see that there is more than one way. That one of the things that can actually really damage our mental health is this feeling that we are somehow trapped in our situation. And that, you know, if many people around me are struggling with the same thing, then there's no answer. And during the pandemic, in many ways, that's exacerbated because we were all struggling in different ways. And so some people don't feel they can speak up or that they maybe should get help because, well, we're all struggling. But, you know, this is clearly something where you found stresses in your own life. There was already something baked into the Dutch culture that you could see, ah, this is different from what I'm used to and what I've experienced elsewhere. There is another way.
Yeah, because if we're all struggling, I think then maybe it helps to feel, okay, this is not my fault. I'm not making myself struggle. It's, you know, it's my circumstance. I think that in the wellness industry, it goes really unacknowledged how our environment and circumstances influence our well-being. I've seen a lot of it in parenting, how, you know, Americans love books, how to parent like the Dutch or like the Germans or like the Scandinavians, without acknowledging that those countries have a really great social support system for parents, kids, and whole families, that it's actually that makes kids and parents thrive and not their behavior. And of course, it's very easy to be a calmer, more patient parent. So I thought it was really important to mention.
Yes, no, I think that's so key. And it can feel very much like that whatever we do badly, we're encouraged to think is our own fault, particularly with mental health, with the stigma of it. We can be encouraged to feel that way and be treated that way. But equally, and I think this is quite a British thing, there can be this encouraging that anything you do well is down to luck or chance.
Yeah.
And so you don't get to claim the good bits, but then all the bad bits are your fault, and it's quite unsustainable.
Yeah, no, not at all. I agree. I do recognize that as well. As yeah, I think that's kind of a very universal thing. The same with I was so interested in finding out if there were other words for doing nothing or similar concept in other languages, and I found that almost every language had something like that. So it wasn't always doing nothing. Although, for example, Italians, of course, have the dolce far niente, which is sweet doing nothing. In English, you can say doing sweet nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many similar expressions in many languages around the world. So that I thought that it was so interesting. And maybe doing nothing or the desire for more free time, for more leisure time. Maybe that was also something universal rather than Dutch, just typically Dutch. Only that the Dutch have a word for it.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And so with you finding the benefits of this, doing so much research into it, how do you find practical ways to incorporate it into your life day to day?
So I usually encourage people to do it in two ways, depending on, for example, what kind of person they are. There are people who like scheduling things. I am not one of those people, but I know they exist. And if you have an agenda or a calendar where you schedule stuff, why not schedule some Nixon time? I mean, we schedule doctor's appointment and conferences and Zoom calls, all kinds of stuff we consider important. We should also consider taking breaks important enough to put them on our agendas.
See, I really want to pause on that because I think for a lot of people, they can feel like an ideal work life for them might be that work can fit more around their other life commitments and the people they love and the hobbies they're interested in and all these other things, rather than what is the dominant experience across the world of your life has to fit around your work. And yeah. So I think that's a really lovely compromise that you've mentioned there of maybe, you know, you don't just schedule in the meetings, you also schedule in the breaks.
Yeah, or just leave those parts for breaks blank so your calendar doesn't look so crowded.
Yeah.
It's a similar solution. It just you schedule it. With Nixon, it doesn't have to be, you know, half an hour or an hour. It could be a few minutes here, a few minutes there. It doesn't have to be this huge thing. And the second way that I like doing, for example, now, of course, I'm not taking the train or buses or anything. When I did, buses or trains are really great for that because you're just there and you don't have anything else to do really except for getting to the place where you have to be. And of course, I take a book with me and you can look at your phone, but sometimes you just gaze out the window and you look outside and see how the landscape is changing. Or you see how, you know, the people in the city, what they're doing. Or when you're waiting for someone, that's a really good place and time for doing nothing. When you're waiting for someone, for the doctor to see you, for your kids to come home, that's usually a good time for doing nothing. Simply, you're just waiting, so you could just as well do nothing.
Yeah, I love that. And it's a lovely way of, I guess, desensitizing us to this productivity pressure that we can be waiting. You know, definitely I experience a lot when queuing. You're waiting in a queue. There's nothing you can do to get there faster to the front of the queue. And yet you can find it really frustrating. And I think part of that is this feeling that we need to be productive all the time.
Yeah, definitely.
That actually there is nothing productive about me feeling stressed about waiting. I just need to wait. And then the other one you've mentioned that I'm definitely guilty for is, you know, on a train, like time and time again, back when we could go on trains, I had that experience of, okay, I've got an hour on this train. I need to make the most of that hour and could actually think quite a bit but ahead of it what I'm going to do. Okay, maybe I've got this task or I'm a bit behind on emails. I'm going to do an hour of emailing. And then sometimes that works. But I think most of the time what happens is the internet connection's a bit dodgy, so I can't really email, or I'm a bit distracted, or I like rushed for the train, and now I'm a bit too like hot and bothered to do anything productive for 10 minutes. So most of the time, I don't have this idealized productivity train environment or something, you know, there's always somebody taking a loud phone call.
Yeah, so I was also thinking about, you know, environment and how our environment affects us. And I think simple thing like putting your phone or your electronics in a place where you can't easily fetch it necessarily be helpful because, you know, out of sight, out of mind. So if you don't see your phone, you won't feel the need to grab it all the time.
Mm.
So then you'll just find other ways to occupy yourself.
Yeah, because it can just really seep in. I don't know if you have experience of this, but do you get it where you often unlock your phone and then you're just swiping between different home pages and you don't remember why you unlocked it?
Yeah, I do that with Facebook a lot. It's kind of interesting because a lot of my articles started as kind of what people said on Facebook, or maybe someone shared a photo or someone shared a movie or something, and I made a story out of that. So I spend a lot of time on Facebook. But yeah, it does happen that I'm watching lots of tasty cooking videos.
Mm-hmm.
Thing, and 5 videos later, I have no idea what I've just watched.
Yeah, and I can't say I've ever made one of them either. As beautiful as they are, they just make me hungry. They don't make me productive.
No, I do make them sometimes, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But mostly it's I watch it and think to myself, I should make one of those one day, and then I don't.
It's another thing on the to-do list.
But it happens a lot that I end up in some kind of rabbit hole of cooking videos, and I just have no idea what I was about to watch or what I've just kind of watched.
Yeah.
Was it a cake? Was it a roast? Was it a cupcake? I have no idea.
Oh dear. And that's it. And I wonder if to an extent that's a bit of overload, that your brain's maybe taken in enough information and actually you should be doing nothing.
Yeah, that's exactly what one of my experts said with working. And I noticed that with myself when I'm writing, after a while of writing, I find myself writing nonsense. Like, this doesn't make no sense whatsoever. It's just rubbish. And instead of trying to beat myself up for not writing beautiful sentences, this is the moment I should probably get up and take a break or do nothing or read something or, yeah, go for a walk or go shopping or do something not writing related. That's how my brain is telling me it's time to take a break.
No, I get that. I certainly do a lot of my best thinking while I'm walking. You know, my time between places is often when I'm doing really important thinking for, okay, who am I going to see? What do I need to talk to them about? You know, this stuff can feel like nothing because we can take for granted our thoughts. We can take for granted that actually we're working things out because if we're not physically doing something, it feels like we're mentally doing nothing.
We don't see that. We don't see thinking. Thinking is invisible, right? So when we're thinking, it looks like we're not doing anything. But for me, as I said, lots of my work is invisible because no one can see me think about my article or no one knows. Yeah, I think it also goes unacknowledged that a lot of creative work is just that. It's walking, it's sitting around, it's not doing very much. But at some point, if you do it long enough, you're going to get, boom, this is my idea and now I'm getting to work. Now I'm getting to this active part.
Right. No, it's true. And it's odd as well, I think, with how we see different roles in society. You know, I've had to have this conversation with my parents before where they're both in scientific backgrounds, they work in medicine. And so for them, they are so used to people studying for years and years. For most people in the UK, it's 7 years to become a doctor. And so for most of that period, they're not getting paid and they're not a doctor yet. And yet, you know, they become a doctor. And so that's a really clear linear path. But for artists, maybe you could be a terrible writer for 7 years in order to become a good writer. But it's not within that same as logical a structure. It's not as formalized. Yeah. And therefore, people don't realize maybe the progress you're making.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because for me, when I think about what I'm doing now, writing for British and American publications in English, my third language, it makes no sense. It makes zero sense for me to be able to, you know, to write for American publications when I've never been to the US. It makes absolutely no sense. And my background is in languages, but especially in German. I have an MA in German, a master's degree in German. But yeah, I'm doing it and it's working. And
But I like that, you know, and that's the skill and the progress of it, isn't it? Because there are plenty of people in the States that have always lived there. And that's the only language they've ever spoken, may not be able to write something compelling about their culture if perhaps that's all they've ever known, or if they don't have those skills of writing as efficiently as maybe you do.
Now actually English has become my main language for writing. It's just what I feel most comfortable writing. That's why, you know, my spoken English and my written English are just so different, because I don't speak much English to people. I speak Polish to my kids, German to my husband, Dutch to Dutch people. I don't speak a lot of English, really. But I do write a lot in English. I've just gotten used to that so much.
So interesting. And of course, you've written this incredible book. So if people want to find that and find out more about you, where should they go?
So I have a website, that's olgamaking.com. But I also have a group, Facebook group called The Nicks in Ears, actually. So they can find me there. So the book is out in the UK already and will be out in the US in January.
Brilliant. January 12th.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Is there any kind of last things you'd want to go out with? Any last message if people are thinking of trying out Nixon?
Well, I have to say, just try it. It sounds a little bit cliche, but yeah, why not?
Give it a go. Grand. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been really fascinating.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Talking about money is hard. People all over the world were taught never to talk about money, politics, sex, or religion in polite company. But on this show, my goal is to remove money from that list. And so I'm excited to bring you 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning from Blind Nil Audio and executive producers Chip and Joanna Gaines. Follow and listen to 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning with me, Carl Richards, wherever you get your podcasts.